As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti. I thank you heartily for joining us this week. And I'm delighted to say that I am joined in the studio by Julian Lorenz and James Scowcroft. Better yet, far better than those two, joining me down the line from an undisclosed location in Ripenden. And this time I believe he is fully clothed. It's Ollie Kay.
You believe wrong.
There you go. We can only fantasize. You know what? Let's face it, though. Hey, I live in a city, and I got windows and people who pass by my house. Presumably, you do too, Julian.
I do indeed.
You've got neighbors as well, Scoey?
Yeah, I have.
Far
yes.
away.
Yeah,
yeah.
Far away in the countryside, usually.
But if you live where Ollie lives, why would you possibly wear any clothes inside your house? Right? There's no real reason to. Am I correct, Ollie?
I thought you were going to say, "Why would you have windows?" This is going in an unexpected direction, but I think basically anyone who works from home, you know, you don't get rest. You don't get dressed until you go and pick up the children from school in the afternoon. Do you? What cause have you got to get dressed?
We digress. Let's move on. We're going to be talking about a pivotal weekend in the Premier League, and we're going to do something we don't normally do and wind the clock all the way back to Friday. Easy question. We're at the place formerly known as the Olympic Stadium, now imaginatively called the London Stadium. Spurs lose 1-0 to West Ham. Is it over, Ollie? And in fact, did it ever begin?
It was a challenge. It wasn't like certain seasons we've had over recent years where it really has been a one-horse race. But it was nearly a one-horse race. I mean, Man City started quickly and couldn't keep it up. And Man United didn't really get going. Arsenal... Liverpool faded. Spurs were the ones who were mounting some kind of challenge, and I think they'd won, was it nine in a row before Friday night. So when people are saying, "Oh, Spurs have bottled it," I think they were 13 points adrift or something around January or New Year's Day or thereabouts. So no, Spurs have not bottled it, but Spurs left themselves with almost no margin for error, and they weren't resilient enough to win 13 on the spin or whatever they would have needed to. But even if they won 13 on the spin, they probably still wouldn't have won it. So, you can't really say Spurs have blown it or Spurs have bottled it, because if Spurs blew it, it was in sort of October, November when the pressure wasn't on.
Scoey, I'm assuming you agree with that assessment.
I was actually at the game with a friend of mine, and I've never seen so much hatred towards one team. West Ham. West Ham wanted to beat Tottenham so badly. And the bloke I was with actually said, he said, for Tottenham, for some unknown reason, all the London clubs, Chelsea are a bit of obsessed with Tottenham. Obviously, they've got the Arsenal rivalry. West Ham are obsessed with Tottenham. And they've got all these London derbies, which I think is so, so tough for Tottenham. And maybe one or two other London clubs as well. But especially Tottenham, there seems to be this sort of anti-Tottenham in London. And West Ham, they were obsessed. And I came out, and it was almost like West Ham had won the World Cup.
Last season, everybody wanted to upend Tottenham, and you could see why. It's Leicester and blah, blah, blah. But it seemed that for a team like West Ham, who you would expect to be on the beach and whatever else, all of a sudden it's Friday night, it's live television, it's Tottenham. And, I mean, is it odd to you that they should derive such pleasure from...
Yeah, I don't know. It's very similar to the Chelsea Spurs of last season, that 2-2 at Stamford Bridge, and I remember being there. And it's exactly the same atmosphere that Scorey has described from Friday night at the London Stadium. It was exactly the same. Like, Chelsea were 12th at the time, I think, last season, or 11th. They're playing so bad. And on that day, they were just very good. They were so good. And you could see from the fans to the bench, the staff, the players, that they just wanted it so badly to beat Spurs, or at least draw to prevent them from trying to catch up with Leicester. And you know, eventually Leicester won the league that night. But it was incredible. So yeah, there's definitely something in there.
Ollie, we're familiar with the term ABU, anyone but United, and you can sometimes understand that, because United have been so dominant, and before that it was probably Liverpool. But A, do you notice this, and is it slightly weird to you, this sort of Tottenham-directed schadenfreude, which seems to be more directed at them than towards other clubs?
I think schadenfreude has leapt into the game in a really big way. I mean, I was hearing on the radio yesterday about Aston Villa's fans going wild at the fact that they denied Brighton the winning the championship title, which, you know, that seems pretty small beer when you look at Aston Villa's history. But you know, there is that kind of, you know, let's be party boopers, let's rain on their parade type thing, which I think appeals to something in football fans a lot of the time. But the Spurs thing, I mean, I don't know, are we overstating this? I mean, I remember Wenger coming out with something similar about Arsenal a few years back, say, "Oh, it's so much harder for us than for Manchester United and for the northern teams because we've got so many derby games in London." As if going to, you know, Fulham and Wimbledon at that time was some incredibly difficult task. I mean, I know Spurs do. There is that sort of rivalry around Spurs, and it's heightened at the moment because Spurs are, you know, Spurs have suddenly got a bit of a strut about them. But
I have never witnessed, and I follow Manchester United a lot, and you've I've been to Leeds with Manchester, I've been to other places, and I've seen hatred that I didn't thought exist, but this was on a level that I thought, wow, this is, and this is my second visit to the Olympic Stadium, or the London Stadium as it is now, and people say, oh, the atmosphere was far better than what I've ever witnessed at Upton Park. It was
really,
it was electric. And you know, I sat in a main stand, I had grown men around me. The language was, just cannot even repeat.
Industrial.
Coming out of the ground afterwards, it was almost like a carnival.
Bringing back to matters on the pitch, like the rest of you, I don't think Tottenham bottled it. I think this is an exceptional season. I think it's going to be statistically their best season since the double in 1961. More importantly, they're showing signs of forward progress. I think this is much more... I wrote this last week and people were like, oh, no, you're stupid. It's all about silverware. I'm like, no, it's not. Because frankly, had they finished fourth and won the FA Cup or the League Cup, you know, who cares? But here they showed themselves to be, you know, viable champions. They're not champions because Chelsea amassed a ton of points earlier and are probably a better side. However, in this game, Julian, I thought Tottenham played really badly.
Yeah.
Was this just inevitable that, you know, basic variance after 9 straight wins?
I don't know. I think they keep doing that. They did the same at Liverpool where they didn't show up. They did the same at United where they didn't show up either. And you do wonder psychologically if Pochettino somehow, away from home especially, needs to change something a little bit. Because it was quite obvious, I thought, on Friday, but I was not there, but in front of the television, to see that West Ham would be so up for it that the Spurs players would have needed to be even more up for it than usually, if you see what I mean. And it almost looked like if no one told them, listen, boys, this is going to be harder than anything before this season because the crowd is crazy. This is the game to win for them. And it looks like they got into the stadium almost like if it was a pre-season match or something. They didn't look like they were ready for it, to win the challenges, to win the second balls. I don't know, it was so unlike them lately. And it's almost like if no one warned them that this is going to be really, really tricky and really hard game, because it looked like they just walked in and expecting to win by not working hard enough. It looked like they were not ready for this game at all.
You almost feel for West Ham. You think, hold on, you've put so much. You know, West Ham have done nothing this season. Yet the tempo that they played with, you just think, where was that been all season? I didn't get it. I just come away and I just thought that it's just the most bizarre evening of football that I'd seen in a long, long time. Either sort of the one team's obsession with beating another I've not seen for a long, long time. But I agree with you. I think Tottenham underestimated it.
Ollie, I'd like you to look into your little crystal ball, because obviously the future's very bright for Tottenham. People are going to debate. In fact, we'll probably continue debating whether to keep these guys together. But I also look at it in terms of how they're going to add to this team. And with the fact that Franco Baldini left, Mitchell left. They spent right around 50 million on Janssen and Sissoko. Is there a risk now that, as great as Pochettino is a manager, you know, they could look back and say, well, if we hadn't spent all that money on two guys who contributed virtually nothing this season and we'd gotten some more help, maybe we'd be in a better position. Is that something that we need to address, or do you trust Pochettino to do it, or do we just make too big a deal out of it?
My concern looking at Spurs would be that if you look at these, if you take these two seasons as a whole, which I know is a very sort of revisionist thing to do, but if you take these two seasons as a whole, they have been by far the most impressive consistent team in the Premier League. I mean, Chelsea won it 1 year and were rubbish the next year. Leicester won it 1 year and were rubbish the next year. Man City, Arsenal haven't really got going. Spurs have been so consistent, and yet they haven't won it. And in fact, they haven't really come that close to winning in those two seasons. And you wonder whether they will look back at these 2 years as an opportunity wasted. And if so, where did they fall short? Were they just not quite good enough, or has there been a slight flaw in their approach when they've gone away to the bigger teams? Because that does seem to have been a problem. And I don't think they're going to have the white hot lane. Well, they're not going to have the white hot lane factor in their favour next season. And playing at Wembley and so on, that does present a few challenges. And I know, yes, they've got Champions League football again, so have a bit more money to spend. But I think they've shown over the years that they are not going to be big spenders. They'll probably commit more to trying to keep their best players than to adding to their squad. And is there a player out there that they could sign that would elevate them to the next level if we assume that the Manchester clubs and others are going to be stronger next season? So it might just be that, you know, an opportunity has been missed here.
Scoy, I want to give you the final word, and I'd like to ask you about a guy whose story fascinated me. Manuel Lanzini was a rising star in Argentina, had the opportunity to move to Europe, and then said, you know what, I'm going to the Gulf so I can make some big cash, settle my family, set them up for life, because I could get run over by a truck tomorrow. So he goes, he does that, he moves to the Premier League, and
earns even more money.
I'm not sure he is, but no. He's still earning.
Or
he's still
adds,
earning.
Adds to the
right, but the point is, I like this guy a lot, and I kind of wonder, sort of, his skill set's a little bit unusual. I kind of get the impression he's kind of thriving since this season, since Payet left, and even when Payet was still there, obviously he was more muted. Does he have another level to go to?
I think he does, and I think if you put better players around him, he would be a lot better as well. So he's definitely the star at West Ham at the moment. He was the one player that got on the ball and could. He's got a very low centre of gravity, technically very, very good. If he was a top four club, you would look at him, really. You've almost got to give him a little bit of a free role, maybe as a 10 or as a on the left cutting inside. But the lad has got a lot of ability and a lot of money, obviously.
Arsenal, Manchester United. In the run-up to this, to the neutral, this felt like the most irrelevant Arsenal-United clash, I think, in a very, very long time. Partly, it's Mourinho's doing, because he announced ahead of time that he was going to make a ton of changes. And he did, obviously, with an eye towards that Europa League semi-final. Ollie, is this normal or surprising that he... I'm not saying he gave up on a top-four finish, but... I mean, you did win away in Spain. Do you really have so little faith in your team at this stage?
It is quite strange. I don't think many managers other than Mourinho would take that approach. And, you look at what Mourinho does, and down the years it has worked extremely well. I know that United have had a few injuries lately, but look at that team yesterday after making 8 changes. Look at the bench they had. It's an extremely deep, strong, experienced squad. And not many of these players have... I mean, how many of them have even played more than 50 games this season? Players often give you the impression that they're not tired unless someone tells them that they're tired. And all we've been hearing from Mourinho is how exhausted United are, how impossible all of this is. And maybe saying different things behind closed doors, but I find it really bizarre. I find his negativity in outlook quite bizarre when he has proved himself such a winner in football. And I look at United this season and I think, well, yes, they've won a cup. They look like they're going to potentially win another cup. But their league form, their league performances, their league results are just not very good. Mourinho can say, oh, you know, we've run out of legs or it's impossible to compete, but it's, I don't know, they just haven't been good. Again, nil away to one of the big teams. They've been lacking ideas, lacking real adventure in the way they play, and they're averaging a goal and a half per game, which after spending goodness knows how many hundreds of millions over on creative and attacking players over the last three summers, I think is unacceptable.
Scully, I'm gonna ask you to react to this. I find personally, just to add this, I find the whole thing bizarre too. Also, some of the players who did play, like, remember early in the season when Mkhitaryan was supposedly too weak to play twice a week and stuff, so he had to wrap him up in cotton wool, and like, gee, who gets to play twice in 72 hours? It's Mkhitaryan. Can you shed some light on this? Because he's rotated all season. It's not like many of these guys have, other than Herrera, who actually, of course, did play, it's not like these guys have played that many minutes.
No, that, you know, what I would say from a former professional point of view, you do get tired. I from my own personal career, when I got to the middle of March, early April, I was just shattered. And you got to take into the mental fatigue, and that's something that we can all relate to, because we all suffer from mental tiredness as well. I can tell you now, these players, from the travelling, the focus that goes into a big game. If it's a Saturday game, you'd probably start preparing on a Wednesday evening. The mental energy, the mental focus that you would prepare for a game. They've got Thursday, they've got to go to Tottenham on Sunday, they've got to go to Southampton on Wednesday. It's just relentless. They just cannot turn off. You're always turning your body around. It takes 48 hours for your body to start feeling normal again. So these lads, naturally, we were going into games with micro tears, you know, mini little injuries. Even if you're sub and you don't get on, you are still kicking every ball. You're still mentally preparing for the game. You're still mentally...
And his best defender and Pogba, probably his best player now that Ibrahimovic is out. Why put those dudes on the bench then? Why not? I mean, this is the part I don't understand, if you're going to make that argument, right? Why don't you get two other duds from the youth team on the bench, or Valencia or whomever? That's the part I don't understand.
Because I think you have to keep the team together, Gab. I don't think all of a sudden, you know, these are away for 2 days. You know, travelling to London, staying in a hotel and that, then all that. So it's not, you can't say to them, right, you go away for 3 days and we'll pick up. You have to keep everybody together.
Okay, you can bring them together, bring them to London, have them stay in the hotel. But if it's so stressful to be on the bench,
why?
It's so tiring.
No.
This is the part, you can't have it both ways.
Maybe you have a point, but can he really do that?
He can do whatever he likes. He's Jose Mourinho. He's a manager. He can go out and say, like, we won't finish top four in the league, like he did. And by the way, the point about these games against Southampton and Spurs that are coming up, when you've already said in public that you're not going to finish top four, I mean, do these games really matter so much?
They do matter, because you're Manchester United and the whole nation's obsessed with and the focus is on them. It does matter.
This team at Arsenal yesterday, they could have won the game. It's not a team that were beaten before. Exactly. So it's not... That's why... Okay, I get the rotation and I get some players get tired, but it's still a very, very competitive team that played in a very negative way again.
The big, big problem is Manchester United are struggling to score goals and have been for a long, long time. Forget fit rotation, tiredness. There is a massive problem here, and it's gone back, you know, almost to the start of the season. Really, they're struggling to score goals, and I don't think anyone can really pinpoint that.
But if you don't try, if you go to Liverpool away and you tell your fullbacks don't go over the halfway line, if you go to City and you tell your fullbacks don't go over the halfway line, if you go to Arsenal and you do the same, you know,
Julian, he's got a right back playing left back that you probably wouldn't want to go over. He's got a 19-year-old making his debut.
No,
what are you going to do?
If you've told your players, okay, make sure that when you lose the ball, we go 10 men behind the ball. We don't leave them space. We don't do this. We don't do that. Instead of telling them...
They're not good enough. I don't think they're good enough collectively good enough to go to a team, go to an Arsenal, go to a Man City, go to a Spurs and say,
This Arsenal
was not good enough to beat Arsenal yesterday.
So you think with the inexperienced fullbacks, one is a lopsided fullback, to go over the halfway, I would think Danny Welbeck, Sanchez, certainly Ozil when he gets a ball, would absolutely destroy you. And I think Mourinho's done the right thing there. And okay, I think he did the right thing with Man City. I think Mourinho's looked at it and think, the best way I can pick points up here is by being defensive.
I disagree. You're Manchester United. You can't go away like that and not score a single goal away from home against the other team from the top six. I think it's just not Manchester United.
To me, I thought what might have changed things was Liverpool drawing. I mean, they knew that Liverpool had drawn that game. why not gamble a little bit and go for the win? Arsenal are not particularly good. Well, what does a draw get you? What does nicking something get you? Exactly. Not to mention the message it sends to these players. People like Mkhitaryan and Martial, they have a future in front of them. They're good players. How about you turn around and say, you know what? You guys are going to go, and we're gonna beat Arsenal because Arsenal are rubbish, and I don't like Wenger, and I've never lost to Wenger. And they've got Rob Holding and Kieran Gibbs at the back, and we're going to go and destroy them. And Ozil is a cipher. How is it possible that the one game where Ozil looks good because he beat two men at one point during the game is against United? How is it possible?
And instead, you tell them, if we lose, it's okay. I don't care if we lose. You know, if we lose, it doesn't matter. Again, you're Manchester United. You're Jose Mourinho. You've got players like Gab said, Marcel and Mkhitaryan and Herrera and Juan Mata, World Cup champions. You can't tell them, oh, we go to Arsenal, but don't worry. If we lose, it's okay.
Not to mention, I'll give you another example, right? What if Eric Bailly falls down the stairs and can't play against Celta and you have to call on one of the two English mannequins to play, right? Well, you've already destroyed these people, right? You said, like, hey, like Jones and Smalling, you're going to go and turn out for the C team against Arsenal. That's how much belief I have in you. He might be right. He might be wrong. You can prove me wrong. Maybe they'll win the Europa League and whatever. But I just say this. This is different from the way Jose Mourinho worked in the past. Whether you think he's right now or whatever, this is a different version that we're seeing when it comes to managing a squad. You agree with that, right?
I think a bit of fear has crept into him.
Maybe. But Ollie, let's talk Arsenal. Do you like this version of the back three? Because Tony Cascarino does not like it. And I have to say, Oxlade-Chamberlain, a game like this, whoa, he's brilliant. Other games, I don't think he has any business playing wingback. Kieran Gibbs at wingback, I simply don't understand. Is this the future for Arsenal, or at least the future between now and whenever Mr. Wenger makes up his mind about whether he wants to stay or not?
I would agree with Tony. I haven't really liked it. I mean, you could say they've got two big wins against Man United and Man City, and they have. But those two games, I didn't think they even had to play all that well. I think City and United were poor against them. Not because Arsenal frustrated them or Arsenal's system got the better of them. I think Arsenal realised in the second half of both of those matches that they weren't up against all that much really, and it was a chance to go win. Maybe the shape suits a few of them, and maybe the fact that it's three central defenders means that it's strengthening numbers, and maybe ends up being a better option than the sort of 4-2-3-1, which just looked so predictable and so stale, really.
And I think the solidity is the idea behind that, is that if Xhaka or Ramsey makes a mistake, then at least you're not too exposed behind.
I had written in my notes the last thing that we're going to discuss about this game is Wayne Rooney, our colleague Matt Dickinson. I'm just going to read you the headline here, which he didn't write, but Rooney huffing and puffing his way to Old Trafford exit. Matt Dickinson watches a player struggle to defy his age with an impotent display. Impotent's kind of a loaded word there, isn't it? Does anybody feel a great need to discuss Wayne Rooney, or can we just move on?
He's finished.
Is anyone surprised, though? I don't think that comes as a surprise. It's not like if he'd been amazing for all season and then suddenly it was bad. He's been rubbish all season. I don't understand why people are surprised or disappointed.
He's failed to influence games now for probably the best part of three seasons.
I'll leave you with this. I think it's something he might have told you in an interview, or it's something you've certainly brought up. How Rooney had said that a few years ago that when he gets older and his legs go, he wanted to play in midfield. I took this to mean, Ollie, when you first wrote about it, that we were talking midfield in terms of him sitting in front of the back four and spraying passes all over the place. When we've seen him do that as well, not with great success. But does this make you sad? Does it leave you cold?
I think it's sad the way his career is petered out. But I think he can spare people a sob story for Wayne Rooney, who's Man United's and England's all-time record goal scorer. I mean, he's not become the player that we perhaps hoped he would be. I don't think he's aged well as a footballer, and I think a few people, smart people, suggested years ago he wasn't going to age well. I think if you look, you know, if people say, oh, well, he's not got back to the form of 2 or 3 years ago, his best form was almost a decade ago, or around a decade ago. It's a long time in the past. I think he's been dropping down the levels since then, and I think he's now at a level where he just doesn't fit at Manchester United. And as Dicko says in the paper, why would a team such as Everton spend a huge amount of their wage bill on a player like Rooney? I don't think he can perform in the Premier League next season.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Did we all watch Match of the Day 2 last night with my mate Mark Chapman? Show of hands.
Yes.
That is your hand, yes. I was fascinated at the end, and this is why I think Mark Chapman's really good at his job. Phil Neville says something, it almost sounds like a throwaway comment about the gap between the Premier League and La Liga. And then Martin Keown says something about the intensity of the Premier League. And then Chappers kind of calls them on it, you know, and asks them to explain their view. I just thought it was interesting because Chapman asked them, and I don't think he was saying they were wrong, but he asked them to explain themselves. And, you know, one of them sort of tied himself up into knots and contradicted himself over and over again. And the other one is Phil Neville. But I'm going to juxtapose this with something that our friend and colleague Duncan Castles wrote. He interviewed this guy named Luis Campos, who is a former Mourinho assistant, then sort of became almost like a head scout, director of football role at Monaco, credited for bringing a lot of these guys in. He's now at Lille. And he said, in the Premier League, they spend a lot of money on attacking players, but the defenders, as a general rule, aren't prized in the same way. Now, I'm asking you, Scoey, you follow French football closely. You've spent a lot of time there. You're looking pensive. Is that fair? Or is it maybe the case that they just spend less time coaching defending? Or maybe that certainly four of the coaches of the top six are generally very attack-minded coaches, the potential exception being Mourinho and Conte. Teams here have more money than the top six in La Liga, right? Why are we seeing so many, especially recently, towards the tail end of the season?
They don't have more money than Real Madrid, do they? Or Barcelona to a certain extent.
Yeah, so. United, City, they're not far off.
Okay,
anyway.
But in the there's many different dynamics, isn't there? There's a lifestyle.
Why is the football not as good, basically, right now? At least, it's, I mean, I think the Premier League is great. I love the Premier League. But if I had to look at the football that the top six have played this year.
Give me more detail.
Well-executed, effective football. To me, that's the definition of good. Let me put it this way. I don't think Jurgen Klopp, when he tides away with his assistant with the long, greasy hair, says, yeah, we've been playing really well for the last three months. I don't think Mourinho would say that. Duncan Castles might. I don't think, certainly would hope Wenger wouldn't say that.
Man United, Man City, Chelsea have these enormous Real Madrid-type budgets. Maybe not quite Real Madrid-type, but enormous budgets. And, you know, our teams are...
So why can they never sign the best players in the world?
Well, they can't sign... The top ten or so, you know, Pogba might be an exception in terms of profile, in terms of ability. Who knows? But when they're signing the top 10 players in the world, it's because they are outspending Real Madrid, Barcelona. That's the only reason why United got Pogba is because they spent a ludicrous amount. But generally speaking,
so Julian will give us a
top 10 player
prime example, the most sought after player probably in this summer or the summer after. Kylian Mbappe, where's he going to go?
In Monaco. He's going to stay for another year. But I think City and United potentially can pay the 120 million.
Like Manchester United can blow anyone out
exactly.
of the water.
Exactly. So they have the same power.
But where is Mbappe going to go?
Yeah, but then it depends.
You're kind of proving Duncan Castle's point here, right? You're going on about Kylian Mbappe, right? This is the guy who worked with Mourinho for a long time, highly respected. He said, you go and you blow your money on attacking players and you don't have the defensive balance. I'd like to take it back to that. And to be perfectly honest,
but you say that, when English teams play Spanish teams, you'd say technically in midfield and going forward, they're better. You wouldn't say, oh, they beat them because defensively they were better.
I don't know to what degree
I think you're just arguing the toss of a coin. I don't think there's any weight behind either argument. It's personal opinion, and I think...
Well, that's why I was interested in hearing yours. But, Ollie, I'm more interested in hearing yours than Julian's.
English clubs blow an enormous amount of money on defenders. Mangala, Otamendi, Stones, that just Man City, Bailly, Lovren, Mustafi... Hugely expensive players. Some of the most expensive defenders in the world. But I've written this before. I don't think there is a culture in the Premier League at the moment of clubs striving to be the best that they can possibly be. They've got some of the best managers. They've got some of the best players. The clubs are in a comfort zone. The clubs are so financially driven. They're more interested in Champions League qualification than setting out to be the best that they can be. Winning the title, winning the Champions League, competing in the Champions League year after year. Everything has been dulled by money, and I totally agree with Phil Neville when he says the level isn't as good as in La Liga. It's complacent, it's comfort zone football, a lot of it, and when people say, oh, the reason Premier League teams don't do as well in Europe is because the Premier League's so intense, and I mean, Real Madrid play sort of 60 games a season, every season, maybe more, including huge intensity games against, you know, Champions League semi-finals, finals, these huge classicos that tend to be about five or six of them a year. The idea that the Premier League is some relentless, unforgiving place where you have to be at your best every week is rubbish because you know, last season, Arsenal finished second in third gear. Man City are going to finish third or fourth in third gear. It's
Ollie, I think you know my views on this. You're 100% correct, and I'll go back to what Scoey said as well about mental fatigue. You mentioned Real Madrid there. Not only do Real Madrid do it, the Real Madrid do it in a far, far more high pressure, taxing environment for the players. I go back to this: every single player who's played in Spain or Italy or France and then goes to the Premier League says, "Hey, I love it here because there's so much less pressure." I'd like you to react to what Ollie said there about the culture of being the best and clubs being in a comfort zone where as long as their balance sheet is okay, they're not really fussed. They're not as ambitious about necessarily winning things because you know what? Finishing top four, signing some marketing deals in China, we made £50 million profit. We have a sold-out share.
Mr. Scudamore's fault, isn't it? Because all of a sudden he's set up
a
league.
Mr. Scudamore doesn't own any clubs.
No. He's set up a league that's just going to attract people that are going to come in and, oh, cash rich, right, let's get... Where Spain don't have that culture. Barcelona have a culture where it's all about a style of play. Real Madrid have a culture where you have to win. And it's not, you know, it's not another...
Right. I'm pretty sure when that Sir Alex Ferguson chap was there at United, I'm pretty sure that was the culture there too, right? And they won, and they made... Bucket loads of money, right?
Taking £1 billion out of the club.
Right, but they were still winning. He still demanded success, Sir Alex, didn't he? No?
He did, but you're looking at...
So you can do the same
League,
thing.
Ollie's spot on. The Premier League has set up a culture where it's money-obsessed, and that comes from the very, very top. If you're on about a winning mentality, don't just go to the players or the manager. It comes from the people that run the club and set the standards.
Ollie, let me ask you this, right? Let's assume this is right. If you were, say, Ed Woodward... Does this mean you should get down to the training ground and get in Jose Mourinho's face and say, like, listen, Europa League's all fine and well, but we have to do a lot better, blah, blah, blah? Or do you say, yeah, you know what? Mourinho puts enough pressure on himself. I'm here to make money. He runs a football side. I don't need to go do that.
But you can see with those big clubs, if Bayern Munich lose in the league, Carlos Rummenigge or Uli Hoeneß are down in the mix zone in the stadium, they've been in the dressing room, they speak to the media and say, this is not good enough. Carlo, this is not good enough. They call on the manager, they call on the player saying, this is not good enough. Same with Real Madrid, same with Barcelona, same in Italy as well in many ways. In England, you never hear the owner, you never hear the CEO or the chairman or, you know, whoever is running the club. Never, ever. The players never see them. The players never see them. The manager never sees them.
Because the minute these guys pipe up, what happens? We in the media, and I'm sorry to say, driven mostly by ex-pros who feel some loyalty towards their manager, say, oh, look, so-and-so chairman is interfering, right? That's the first thing we say. We can't have it both ways. We can't complain about there's no pressure or culture from the owners and their representatives, right? And at the same time, say, you know, say they, oh, but when they do speak up, they're interfering.
Does Stan Kroenke care whether Arsenal finish first or fourth?
No, he doesn't. Absolutely, but I imagine Ivan Gazidis does care.
Do the Glazers? Does Ed Woodward care? If the Glazers cared whether United finished... In fact, no, I'll put it another way. What would the Glazers want? Man United to be European champions or Man United to be top of that football rich list year after year? I don't even have to answer the question. It's obvious what the Glazers' priority is, which is reflected in a... in the decisions that they've made.
Okay, well, hang on.
My point is right. These are the people at the very, very top.
But not every club is Arsenal or United.
No, so
that may apply to the Glazers.
City are a little bit different because for them, Abramovich is all about winning. You know, he's got money, so he doesn't want any more money.
And he keeps winning.
Yeah.
Okay. So is it, do we accept that?
Cup, wins the league.
Do we accept that maybe the culture of winning is slightly different certainly at City and Chelsea, possibly at Liverpool too, because they haven't really won.
City's a little bit different because they're trying to establish this brand, aren't they, of Man City's global, blah, blah, blah. I think Chelsea are the mentality you've seen this season.
Well, we also see it in the fact that they actually fire managers and keep winning, right? Yeah. I mean, in terms of club culture, right? Yeah. Hey, City have won, since they've had money, they've won with Mancini, they've won with Pellegrini. They'll presumably win at some point with Pep. It's only his first season. Abramovich has been through a bazillion managers, and most of them have won. Is that the answer, Ollie?
If United had been... fourth, or Liverpool fourth, or Arsenal fourth, yet with a chance of winning the title going into the final weeks of the season, yet also a chance of dropping out of the top four altogether and missing out on the Champions League. I think if you went to the owners of those clubs and said, stick or twist, stay where you are, or twist, and you might win the league, but you might drop out of the top four. I think those owners that I'm talking about, Liverpool, Arsenal, United, American owners, coincidence or not, I don't think so, They would say, no, we'll stick with our top four, our Champions League football. I really believe that. I don't believe there is a desperate desire for Manchester United to be champions.
The strange thing is, the Champions League, as in finance terms, doesn't really make a massive difference to a club like Manchester United. It's a drop in the ocean, the money that they'll miss out on.
I'm not sure.
They keep saying that. Right? Ed Woodward, blah, 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 keep saying this over and over again. But actually, brands are built on exposure. United right now have tremendous exposure and are one of the strongest footballing brands in the world because of what happened in the Sir Alex era. Give it a few more years like this.
Yeah, but because of everything they want. If they don't win anything for the next 20 years, money might still come and will still come, but the brand won't be as strong as it is if they win the Champions
League.
In the
70s, my friend, Manchester United were a second division football club and still had the highest attendances in the whole of the country.
That's 50 that's, years ago.
That's come on. 40, actually.
If you don't play Champions, you know, if you win the Champions League for the next 5 years in a row, surely
when you're talking about those contracts for ball bearings and toothbrushes that Indian mobile phones. You know, that's driven by the fact that they see the United on television playing and beating the best teams in the world. There's enough people around who still remember that from when it happened regularly.
I agree.
Right? You're not talking about the people in the 1970s who paid sixpence or whatever to go and stand at Old Trafford. That's a different sort of fan. That's a more important fan, if you will, and some might say. And that's part of the history of the game. And that's probably where you would be if you hadn't been blessed with a chance to play professional football. But those aren't the people who get Woodward that additional money that helps him earn his bonus. It's the people around the world who view United as a brand. I could talk about this for hours, but we need to move on. Fraser Forster saves a penalty. Southampton park the bus and get a point in Anfield. Julien, they're 10th, and they have games in hand. So why are some nasty media types reporting that your mate Claude Puel could be elsewhere next year? And does it only happen if the club gets sold?
I don't know. It's weird. It might have something to do with Brexit or something. You don't like French people anymore. But
he is a bit French.
I mean, they're only 3 points away from eighth place, which if they finish eighth, would be a very good season, considering they also went to a cup final. You know, they don't know.
Their best players every year.
Yeah, exactly. I think
Virgil van Dijk gets injured.
There's a lot of injuries. I was going to get there. I think for Puel, it's a very, very good first season. What?
Only 8 points off relegation.
Yeah, but that's French people just see forward, not backwards. But I think people have been really harsh with Puel, fans included, Southampton fans included. I think he's done a very good job with what he had. And considering, again, it's his first season, the language is not so perfect yet. At least he tries, not like other foreign managers in the league. Yeah, and so I think people have been a bit harsh.
Speaking of Liverpool, it's definitely 2 points dropped, isn't it, Ollie? And are you okay with all the theatrics ahead of James Milner's penalty? All the things that they did to put poor James Milner off, and then Forster kind of playing dumb afterwards on television, where he comes out looking like Frankenstein and saying, like, whoa, I didn't do anything. No, I mean, well done, the save, nothing wrong with it. The referee lets you get away with it. But what did you make of all that, Ollie?
There was something like a 2-minute delay between the decision and the kick being taken, and it did feel like the tension just built and built in the ground. That's in the stands. Never mind what it must have been like for Milner, where he's got Fraser Forster sort of looking down on him like that. And Milner said it didn't get to him, but I thought it looked like it might have done, despite the fact that it actually looked like a decent penalty. I thought Forster should have been booked in the same way that Ward Barris was booked for time wasting, but a yellow card. Well, that's it's no big deal. It's a bit of gamesmanship. It should probably have been a yellow card, and nobody would have complained.
Ollie, if Graham Souness or Steve McMahon or some of those Liverpool hard men of yesteryear had been on the pitch, do you think somebody might have come up to like back up James Milner and get Gigantor out of his grill?
Yeah.
I was a bit surprised by that, because you see this little guy standing all by himself, and you've got Fraser Forster invading his personal space.
Liverpool are a team that have been accused by me and others of lacking leaders and lacking steel and resilience. And
are they too nice?
I think what...
Who's nasty on this Liverpool team?
Absolutely nobody.
Lovren has an edge, no?
Lovren has an edge, yeah. But it's a nice team. That Man United team, Mourinho might talk about them as being sort of this warrior spirit and resilience, so on, but that is a very nice Manchester United team. It's a very nice, gently Arsenal and Man City team. It's probably too nice a Tottenham team, and maybe Chelsea are going to win it because they've got a bit more of a mean streak.
I tell you what, if that had been City, I think you would have seen Kompany, Otamendi, Fernandinho, all those people going and sticking up for their penalty taker. Speaking of City, they stomp all over Crystal Palace, winning 5-0 as David Silva steals a show and both centre-backs get on the score sheet. Scoey, it seems like a far more orthodox setup from Pep that we've seen in the last few games. Is it a case of needs must, or do you think this is just a different Pep and we'll see a slightly more orthodox?
It certainly will be interesting to see how he plays, especially in Europe next season, because I think his total football philosophy, style of play, whatever, I don't think wins trophies in the Premier League. I think you need to show the other side again. I think they certainly need to...
He's showing it now, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. And to be fair, getting the ball down, putting it in the box as a free kick, getting your centre-half up to head it scores goals. You know, that's how you win games of football. So it'll be interesting if we see a little bit more of that next season. I think Palace were awful on Saturday.
But they have no centre-backs. That's his alibi. Sticking to it. Looks like Burnley are staying up following their 2-2 draw with West Bromwich Albion. Julian, I feel like I ask this question every week, but does Sean Dyche kind of get lost in the shuffle? I know at least one ex-pro said that he should be in the top three for manager of the year.
I agree with you, Gab. I think it's a shame. He deserves a lot of credit for keeping this team up, considering they haven't spent that much money. They did spend some money, both in January with Robbie Brady, for example, and last summer as well, but nothing like others, for example, if you want, and still doing a very good job, especially at home. And I think they've got a very, very good record at home, and he deserves a lot of credit for that and for keeping the club up. Well done.
Can you name two Burnley players who aren't bang average?
Who are not bang average?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think...
And you wonder why sometimes pros don't have respect for journalists.
Yeah, let me ask you. Who are not bang average by Premier League standards?
I think Tom Heaton is a very, very good goalkeeper.
Yes.
Michael Keane?
Yes. Who is above average in the Premier League?
So Heaton.
Heaton, Keane.
Heaton, Keane, for sure. I think...
Hendrick has his moments, but he's not exactly a model of consistency.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I'm sorry. I'm looking at this lineup. I'm not having a go. I think it's tremendous what they've achieved.
Bang average. If I was a Burnley player and I was in the studio and you say you're bang average.
Okay, well then I would refer you to your paycheck, to your international caps, to your Premier League experience, okay. And I would compare it to the data set of Premier League managers, and I would say Premier League players say like, yes, all these people have more than I do, and yes, guess what? I'm staying in the Premier League next season, and you, Sunderland, you, Middlesbrough, are going down. I think it's something to be proud of, frankly.
And Stephen Defoe is a lovely little player as well.
Yeah, although he's kind of disappeared.
He's on the bench, yeah, a bit. But
you're right. You're a bang average journalist.
He's done very good.
Call me whatever you like. Yeah, but, I mean that doesn't.
Yeah, he'd be upset though.
He's done very well with what he has and had this season, especially
budget
like you said,
is what it is.
Yeah, and they were far more stronger squad than his that have gone down, or would go down.
Hull contrived to somehow lose at home to Sunderland. Ollie, would you rather explain this weirdness or perhaps explain how Defoe wasn't judged to be offside on that second goal?
The second goal, I mean, it was academic, really. Well, unless Hull go down on goal difference or something, it is academic, really. The game was lost by then. But although it's a curious phenomenon is the sort of dead cat bounce of a team that's already relegated and then suddenly produces a performance with the pressure off, as Sunderland did. And maybe the pressure and expectation that Hull haven't felt all season was there on their shoulders on Saturday game. Everyone expected them to win, so slightly surprising result.
I think they put in a performance because Moyes said that he was willing to stay next year.
It almost seemed like, you know, they were talking about next season starts here. Maybe players are thinking, well, I need to play to to make sure I'm here next season, or they might be thinking I need to play to make sure I'm in the Premier League next
exactly.
season. So it's just a shame that didn't start really till it was too late.
Nobody in the bottom half of the table has scored more non-penalty goals this season than Fernando Llorente, who has 13, including the one that lifted Swansea past Everton. Scoey, how about you show some love to your fellow big man?
Show a lot of love. I think he's a very, very good player, very effective. I saw him play in Paul Clement's first game, which was at Crystal Palace, and he was outstanding that night. I think he's very good in the box. He attacks the ball well, but technically he's good as well at receiving the ball and linking it up.
If he'd been up front for United playing against Nacho Monreal and Rob Holding on Sunday, would United have won?
If I'd have played up front for Manchester United on Sunday, we might have won.
There you go.
Gab, one for you. Somebody named Jorge Sister Speller apparently passed away over the weekend. Who was he and why does it matter?
It's a remarkable story. It's an extraordinary story to tell. Somebody I had the opportunity to meet. Jorge Sister Speller was born with some sort of degenerative disease. He walked with a limp ever since he was a child. His older brother, he lived across the street from the stadium of Argentinos Juniors in Buenos Aires. His older brother played for Argentinos Juniors, died tragically in a car accident when he was 20. He idolized him. Everybody felt sorry for him. And so the club allowed him to go and basically hang out there. While there, he met a 10-year-old kid who had just started at their academy. A young boy named Diego Armando Maradona. There was 2 years difference between the two. Maradona eventually moved in with Sister Spiller, so he wouldn't have to commute sort of an hour and a half each way to get the training every day. And Sister Spiller, at the age of 20, negotiated Maradona's move to Boca Juniors. Following year, he negotiated what was the largest global sponsorship of a footballer in the world at the time with Coca-Cola. Later, he negotiated his move to Barcelona, which was a world record, and later a world record move to Napoli as well. They later fell apart. Maradona got in with some different people. But in some ways, he really was the first really high-profile agent who really made tons of money for his client. And the remarkable thing about him was that he really was just a kid when he went and he negotiated these enormous deals. And I like to think that today's super agents, whether they be Mino Raiola or Jorge Mendes or Jonathan Barnett, that they take a moment to think about this guy who really blazed the trail for them. Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many thanks to my excellent guests, Julian Lawrence, James Scowcroft, and from beautiful Ripondon, Ollie Kay. Remember, if you want to subscribe to our newspaper, it's just £12 for a 12-week trial. And if you do so, you will be able to access legal highlights of every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, FA Cup, and even the SPFL, which I believe is the Scottish Premier Football League. You can press that subscribe button on wherever you choose to download your podcast, and you can leave us a review on iTunes if you're listening on an Apple device. We're going to be back next week.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.